Hello, one and all, and welcome to this week's Companies and Markets podcast. I'm Mark Robinson. I'm standing in for Ian Smith, John Heumann, Alex Newman. In fact, I'm pretty much the announcer of last resort. But it's been a busy week for the magazine, and I'm joined in the studio with my colleagues Megan Boxall, Tom Dines, and a little bit later we'll be talking to Simon Thompson from his Kent Redoubt. Firstly, I think we'll bring Tom in on a couple of news stories linked to companies in the support services sector. Always a hive of activity, but there's been a few problems actually, Tom. The first one is Mitie, who released a somewhat worrying announcement through the week.
Yeah, so they've announced that they are being investigated by the FCA over the timeliness of their profit warning in September last year, and also the manner of preparation and content of the company's financial information, position and results for the financial year ended March 2016. There's actually the second investigation going on into those 2016 results. The FRC is looking into Deloitte for their 2015 and 2016 numbers. So two concurrent investigations, rather.
Okay.
Probably not the best signal.
I mean, part of the problem as well was we've highlighted in the past as well, the extent of their write-downs as well. That's been an issue with the company.
We have, and they have, but since the timing of this announcement, they've kind of grabbed the bull by the horns. They did an accounting review, wrote down 88 million of impairments, exceptionals, stuff like that. And they've really been kind of getting their act in gear.
So it's not really an issue of corporate governance, anything along those lines?
No. As far as I can tell, no. That said, they are still being, roughly 7% of the stock is being shorted.
Okay.
At least that's as much as we could glean from FCA disclosures. I tried to speak to some of the hedge funds.
But they wouldn't make a comment either, the FCA, at the point.
No. And weirdly enough, neither would hedge funds.
No, I suppose it's an ongoing affair as well. So
they don't like
it's unlikely.
Short positions with
exactly. The other company within the support services sector was WIG. It's a company I've covered in the past. And what seems to have been the problem there?
Everything. So that's another profit warning. They've said operating profit for the 6 months to the end of September going to be significantly lower than 2016.
I see. And we did have the company on a buy, did we not?
We did, on the basis that they have warned earlier this year.
Yes.
That warning was Brexit-related delays. None of the contracts that were being delayed had been cancelled. It was just a bit of nerves around Brexit, which we've seen elsewhere and has often not turned out to be anything. This is quite a few things. So I'm going to have to read this because there's four separate issues. So two major projects in the international development business have taken longer than expected to get off the ground. A review of the consultancy businesses revealed some engineering contracts are likely to be less profitable than expected. Framework contracts for the division have been slow to deliver. Planning and transport planning and real estate have failed to meet expectations. So there's quite a few different things.
But is this contractual problems are germane to the sector, really? I mean, this is something that comes out all the time. And yeah. I guess you've got a limited number of outsourcing companies, you know, chasing down a limited pool of business as well. Mm. And I think this is where you end up getting contractual issues, really. So have we changed our view on the company? I mean,
yeah, so
we've taken them to a sell now, is that right?
WIG is a sell. Mitie was staying on hold just because we don't know what this means. Mitie said they're not going to say anything else until the investigation's concluded.
And so we're neutral on them at the moment as well.
The one outsourcer that's had some good news this week is Serco. So they're up 7.6% on Thursday morning. That's after UBS put out a note on the outsourcing sector in which they upgraded Serco, saying they were quite a late stage in their turnaround.
That was the reason in the end, was it? Because there was no separate RNS announcement, was there?
No, it was purely on the back of this note. So the same note said that they were going to keep sort of Mitie and
It's a long road back for Serco, though.
Not if you're UBS.
Well, yeah. It's good news on that front, anyway. Okay, Tom. Well, thanks very much for that. I dare say that there'll be other news coming out of that particular sector in the weeks and months ahead. This week's issue, actually, I should have alluded to it in the introduction, really, is basically been put together by my other guest here, Megan Boxall. And Megan's written this week's cover feature looking at the future direction and shape of TV. Quite appropriate, really, given that we've just seen the unfortunate passing of Bruce Forsyth, who is synonymous with the dawn of TV in this country.
He wasn't that old.
No, perhaps not. It was old, 1930. Well, commercial TV in this country anyway. But enough about Brucey. So, Megan, you've used a distinctly literary prism to cast your eye on the world of television. What are the major trends that you've identified?
It's been a really interesting feature to write, because the changes in TV are just huge. And also something that everyone kind of knows about, because pretty much everyone watches television, but how it impacts the companies, all the huge amount of companies in the market, has been really, really interesting. So, I mean, anyone who owns TV will know about the changes that have happened. We now have so much more content at the press of a button.
I remember discussing the feature with you ahead of time as well, and I think that the problem was there is such a vast change going on out there and so many different issues, it was difficult to sort of synthesize this into one article.
Yeah, I know, definitely. But so looking at the sort of changes in behavior was quite a good place to start, because there have been so many changes in how we watch TV, and they've been kind of driven by the fact there's so much more content out there. It's all like when you go on Netflix, full series are put up in one go. Yeah. And you don't even have to press a button for the next episode to start. It's lethal. You can end up watching a whole series of one episode of one program in one sitting.
Well, I did on the weekend.
It's
happened.
So easy to do.
I know, it's ridiculous.
What did you watch?
Ozark. I recommend it highly.
it's so easy to do. So binge TV is a thing that has become massive in the UK and the US, everywhere that Netflix has got a grasp on the market. But we also are watching more and more TV on the move. I mean, the amount of people you see on the tube catching up on the latest episode of their favourite programme on their iPad or even their phone. Our tablets and our phones have got better quality. The connection, mobile reception's got better. Everything has become, it's become easier to watch TV.
I guess it feeds into that general narrative we've spoken about before as well, where people today, they actually don't buy their music as such. They don't buy albums, or fewer people do. They access it through sites such as Spotify. Even when you go and buy a car nowadays under PCP arrangements, you don't actually end up owning the car per se. You just move it on to a newer model. And this seems to be an established consumer trend now.
Yeah, It seems to sort of be a little bit the same in television, but also we were talking the other day about how actually you can end up spending just as much as you used to on TV. So everyone still in the UK has to pay their licence fee, and that's still the law. Then a lot of people pay for Sky. But then, and Sky is very expensive. Fewer people paying for BT, also pay TV channel, very expensive. But then there is a slight downturn in the people buying those channels, those very expensive channels, and instead turning to streaming services such as Netflix and Amazon Prime and Now TV. But if you have all three of those,
that's more in line with the Spotify model,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, okay. You stream directly from the internet. The fact that broadband's better now, that's enabled us to watch TV in that way. But yeah, you end up paying just as much as you would for a month's Sky subscription, because you've got all three channels, and then £6, £7 coming out of your account every month, you don't even notice it. But
well, this is true.
But all these channels.
From what you're saying there, it seems like cost in itself isn't necessarily the main consideration, but it's that flexibility and the differing way that we consume media.
Yeah, definitely. And also the massive thing is the value of content. And that's one of the things that I've been looking at quite a lot, because content is so much more valuable now than it used to be, because that is why we pay for Netflix. That's why we keep our Sky subscription. Sky is the only place in the UK that shows Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
That is a massive draw for a company like Sky. If it loses Game of Thrones, how many people are going to say, well, I don't care about Sky anymore? If it loses its rights to the Premier League, which is the debate going on at the moment, how can it actually afford the cost of the Premier League? If it loses those rights, are people going to want to pay for Sky?
What's left? But I mean, you also alluded to the fact that this is changing the media production model as well. Mm.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. And ITV is a big company in that sector. It's actually the biggest production company in the UK. It's got loads of different companies that make programmes for the BBC, for Sky, for all sorts, and they ship them overseas as well.
Okay, and another area that's there's obviously implications for is marketing.
Yeah, so historically, the television was the biggest destination for advertising spend in the UK. And that has changed dramatically with the rise of Facebook and Google. Their way of advertising products is so much more efficient than when companies choose to advertise on the TV.
It's the targeting aspect,
yeah, exactly.
Isn't it?
So when you, I don't know, when you search on ASOS for a pair of shoes, the Facebook has the capacity to tell that you've been searching on ASOS for a pair of shoes and advertises those pair of shoes when you go on Facebook. It's so much better. It's so much more. It's a much better way of advertising. The companies are bound to go for that form of advertising rather than for the television. So that's been a real problem for TV companies. ITV has really struggled with falling advertising revenue. Sky previously had been struggling with falling advertising revenue, so had BT. Sky has started this new advertising model where it can also target adverts to specific populations. So a family in Edinburgh and a family in London can be watching the same programme, but the family in Edinburgh will be watching a different advert to the family in London.
Right.
Which is, it's not quite as targeted as what Facebook and Google can do, but it's better than the historic TV model.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are definitely ways that the TV companies can get around the drop-off in demand for TV advertising. And if the content is there, and if the viewers are there, as we've seen with Bake Off this week, people are going to pay big bucks for advertising slots. A Bake Off, Channel 4, sold their two sponsorship deals worth £5 million for the entire series. And they're selling advertising slots for between £150,000 and £200,000, just because that is really, really premium content. That's what they know, they're going to get high viewers, so people are willing to pay for the advertising slots.
Well, advertising itself, it's an industry in flux, and it's very difficult to establish what are the best ways you can generate revenue streams through in the digital age. I mean, we find it in our own world here, you know, as part of the FT group. It's central to considerations. And so what are some of the other changes as well that you've noticed in terms of the growth of the industry? Has it become more fragmented?
Almost actually the opposite. I mean, there are so many companies which are in partnership with each other, which are doing deals with each other, which are thinking about buying each other up. There's been a definite sort of convergence between the telecoms companies and the broadcasters and the companies that make content. All companies that are making the content, they need a source to get rid of, to be displaying that content, which is one of the reasons that AT&T is trying to buy Time Warner. It's passed by regulators, it's going to be the biggest corporate acquisition in history.
Yeah, that's dragged on for some time, though, isn't it?
Dragged on for ages. Yeah. I thought it completed, but it hasn't. It's still going on. And it's so Fox and Sky as well. Fox is trying to expand its reach into Europe. It's going to try and take full control of Sky. ITV has been buying so many production companies. It's got the outlet for displaying these programmes. It just needs the content with these programmes. And then in the US, Disney is doing something very similar. Disney is the king of content. I mean, no one's going to stop watching Disney films as long as they continue to be as great as Frozen was. But what they've struggled with is the fact that they don't have a portal to display all their films, all their programs. So they are launching their own rival streaming service to Netflix. And with the content there, that could be a big problem for Netflix. Netflix has to invest in its own content to challenge that. It's all going on.
It's strange, actually, because I recall during the late 1980s and into the 90s as well, you had a period of intense consolidation within the media industry as well. This is why you've ended up with Time Warner, for instance. What are some of the implications for public broadcasting in the United Kingdom?
Yes, that is such an interesting question and one that there just does not really seem an answer to. But the BBC is obviously the biggest public service broadcaster. The others are ITV, Channel 4 and Channel 5. Whether they can even be called public service broadcasters in the sense that they used to be is definitely a matter for dispute. Channel 5 is owned by a massive American company.
Yeah.
ITV has its own production studios now. It's making a lot of money from production companies. And the BBC even has its own production arm in which it sells its own programmes. And it's got its commercial worldwide service. So whether or not it's still a public service broadcaster in the historic sense of the word is definitely a question. And
well, there's a general debate going on about charter reform for the BBC anyway, yeah, looking at broadcasting standards, but it's also going to have to actually take account of the changing economics of the industry.
I mean,
the BBC can't avoid it.
No, and that's what's quite difficult, and that's why sort of all the arguments around BBC staff pay. I understand that it's a tax-funded organisation. They have a responsibility to spend their money wisely, but also when the average market rate is going up so much for staff, for programmes, they have to match it. Otherwise, they're going to lose all their content. They're going to lose all their Gary Linekers and Chris Evans, and maybe that might not be the biggest loss. I think people would start complaining if their news started to be broadcast by someone who wasn't a very good journalist. They kind of have to be matching the changes to the market, which kind of calls into question, is the licence fee going to be a thing in the future?
I wonder how much Brian Moore used to get paid.
Probably not as much
as Lineker, even in real terms. Yeah. Okay, listen, it's an absolutely fascinating piece, actually. It's been some time in the making as well, but tremendously well done on that. What about, I guess for our readership, I mean, there's any number of investment implications as well, but I guess at the moment it may be, short of the consolidation that I alluded to earlier on, it's hard to come up with some concrete themes there.
Yeah, it really is, especially as like we were talking about, all the companies, they're just undergoing such rapid change. We really like ITV. And they've got a really sensible strategy of buying up production companies. That's where the value is in the future of TV. It's in that content. And the fact that they're putting a lot of money into that content is a good sign. But while all the drop-off in advertising revenue is going on, it makes ITV look like it's struggling, even though in the future it might actually be very well placed. So it actually looks quite good value. And today I was doing the looking at the results of STV, which is the broadcaster of ITV, or the third channel in Scotland, and them as well. They're really trying to diversify into content and into new channels rather than really relying on advertising. So I think the companies that can place themselves for those changes, and ITV and STV both look like they're doing that. Sky, I mean, you have to kind of assume that it's not going to be a UK-listed company within a year, should the Fox deal go through. But yeah, I think it's content that needs to be the thing to look for, which is why Entertainment One is maybe another
content
good bet.
Is key.
Exactly
is what you're saying. Mm. Okay, listen, it's a great piece again. Actually, Megan looks wistfully back to the days when the family used to be able to sit round the TV set watching it in the traditional fashion. It just shows you she has a slightly different aspect on the world than I. But it's a wonderful piece anyway. I recommend it. Luckily, we're joined on the line now by Simon Thompson, who's going to look at the companies that he's been covering recently. How's it going, Simon?
It's going well. Looking forward to the weekend, and hopefully the good weather will return that we had in the bank holiday.
I know. Well, it's a good time to speak to us anyway, if it's pelting down outside.
It's definitely pelting down outside.
Okay, listen, you've singled out a couple of the companies on your watch list today. The first is Currency Manager Record, which for several years has looked like an excellent investment, and it hasn't always proved so, but is having a pretty good 2017. Why is that?
It's having a fantastic time. I mean, if you look at the geopolitical situation, problems in the Middle East and Asia, the fallout from Brexit, the EU referendum last year, Donald Trump's presidency last November. You've had the French elections in May, German elections coming up. You've got a whole host of things that have led to volatility in the currency markets.
Yeah.
On top of that, you've got the European Central Bank and the US Federal Reserve Central Bank.
A couple of elections in Europe this year as well.
Absolutely, you know the German election is the next major one,
mm-hmm.
but you've also got the monetary tightening as well, which is leading to some fairly major moves in the currency markets. I mean, for example, the euro has appreciated 14% against the US dollar since April. It's appreciated 10% or so against sterling in the same time, and in this backdrop, institutional investors, and Record's got 59 large clients, are looking at both dynamic hedging mandates to profit from these currency moves, as well as passive ones. And it's the passive side that really interests me. And records in the last financial year to the end of March, the revenues from that side grew 29%, and now actually account for more than half of the management fees.
Okay.
They cover all the operating expenditure of the business, which is quite important because this company's cash rich. Profits are going up. They were up 26% or so last financial year, expected to go up another 12% this year. But with cash on the balance sheet and the management fees actually covered by covering the overheads, then the board can be really generous with the dividend.
Well, this is the next point I wanted to ask you as well. Have they got an explicit policy in that regard?
Well, they have. I mean, they've basically come out and said that they will, on top of the normal dividend, they had a normal dividend of 2 pence out of earnings per share of 2.9 pence last year. But above that, they'll actually pay out special dividends. And for the year just ended, so they paid out last month, in effect, all the earnings they made, all the 2.9 pence. Okay. They also had a £10 million tender offer, which shrunk the share capital by 5.5%. But the company still retains surplus cash, roughly £13 million or 6.5 pence a share. That compares with a share price of 46 pence. And that's after setting aside about £9 million of its cash for regulatory capital purposes. What this means is tender offer, that previously analysts were looking for earnings to grow roughly 10% this year from 2.9 pence to 3.2.
Mm-hmm.
But having shrunk the share capital, then, and given the capital that they returned wasn't earning any interest income,
sure.
Earnings per share are actually more likely to grow 17% to 3.4 pence this year. And if the boards do what they've just done, which I see no reason why they shouldn't do in the forthcoming financial year, and actually return all those earnings to shareholders, then the forward dividend yield is almost 7.5%. And on top of that, the shares, when you strip out the cash on the balance sheet, the free cash on the balance sheet, the shares are only trading in 11.5 times cash adjusted earnings per share. So it's not expensive.
Yeah, not all the time. I mean, I guess it all comes down, like every other company, to what's happening with the underlying earnings. You say with the capital changes, that's going to have an effect. But why are you confident that the earnings upgrade cycle will continue?
Well, I've gone through the housebroker's forecast, and he was looking for revenues to roughly increase from just under £24 million last financial year to £25.5 million. So that's about 6% growth, which seems quite realistic given the backgrounds of monetary tightening and geopolitical risks that are heightening foreign exchange market volatility. If they generate that 6% revenue growth, underlying pre-tax profits will roughly rise by £1 million to £8.9 million. And I think that's pretty fair estimates.
Okay.
And that'll just feed through to those earnings per share figures that I gave. So, you know, realistically, it could do 3.4 pence compared with 2.9 pence of earnings per share in the current year, return all of that back to shareholders. So you're buying shares in a company that, admittedly, they've risen 86% in the last 12 months, and they've done really well since I included them in my 2015 bargain share portfolio.
But okay.
I still think there's another 30% or so upside to the share price.
Yeah, and of course, the income benefit as well. When did you first identify them? Did you say, was that in your bargain shares?
That was bargain shares 2015. So
okay.
February 2015, 34 pence was the share price.
So you've caught all that growth, really?
Well, including the dividends, we're up about 50-odd% on that holding. So, I mean, as you said, it didn't do well for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just absolutely bolted this year, and I think the momentum's going to continue as well.
So just from a thematic angle as well, you know, with these type of companies, as you said before, you know, volatility in markets and on the political sphere is actually a sort of boon for them.
Well, I mean, you can see that. I mean, the assets under management they've got, they were roughly up 10%, $58 billion in the 12 months to end of March. They had their first quarter figures a few weeks back, and it's now up round about the $60 billion mark. So they're actually generating growth. So not just from existing clients, but they're actually pulling in clients as well. So it's all positive.
It sounds it at that. We might move on to the other company you've highlighted today, which is Satellite Solutions. I'm not actually familiar with them. So can you just give us a bit of a rundown on the company and what the valuation's looking like at the moment?
It's really interesting. Basically, what this company does is provides satellite superfast broadbands to consumers, businesses, schools in rural areas that just really can't tap into the fiber network. And since January 2015, it's made 14 acquisitions until the end of June this year, acquired roughly 70,000 customers. It's actually grown those customers to over 76,000, mm-hmm. and that type of customer growth actually is feeding through to the like-for-like sales. So they had their first half results on Thursday, the 31st of August, and those results showed that like-for-like revenues are actually growing by 13%, and that growth has actually continued into July and August as well, I understand from the directors. High recurring revenue streams, 94% of the total. The type of money that you actually pay for this service, the average revenue per user is roughly £40. Well, that compares to offers of around about £20 or less for fixed broadband on the fiber network. If you go to people like TalkTalk, BT, Sky, etc., you take one of their special offers. So it's more expensive, but you've got to bear in mind that if you don't have access to the fiber network, your options are limited.
Yeah.
Satellite Solutions is one of the biggest providers in this area. It's now got 96,000 customers. Its target was to have 100,000 by November this year. And by scaling up the business, it's turned from a loss-making company to one that's actually growing cash profits very, very quickly. It turned in cash profits of £2 million in the first 6 months of this year. It's predicted to do roughly £2.5 to £3 million in the second half. The highest broker at Numis Securities is predicting cash profits of 6.4 in the year to November 2018. So it's a pretty big step change. And I think those forecasts are justifiable when you actually look at the acquisitions they've made, the benefits that they've actually generated from them in terms of cost savings.
Is this still a relatively fragmented marketplace?
It is. I mean, they're one of the biggest companies in Europe. Their French business, for example, has got 12,000 satellites. These are all consumers, users actually using their network. They basically Satellite Solutions buy capacity off the big satellite providers and then basically resell it on to consumers, businesses, and schools. But the big change is that lots of governments have now realized that the fiber network alone is not enough to actually get everyone onto superfast broadband.
Yeah.
And a good example of that was in France. Just recently, new President Emmanuel Macron announced plans there to accelerate the rollout of high-speed broadband coverage across the country. He's brought forward the target from 2022 to 2020. Well, Satellite Solutions has roughly 12,000 customers in France, making it probably, well, it is one of the largest independent satellite broadband providers there. Interestingly, President Macron said that the rollout cannot be done by fiber alone. So although there's almost 30 million households in France that are actually connected to the fiber broadband network, there's 2 million that just can't be connected either economically or just logistically, they can't. So basically, it's going to have to be satellite, optical fiber, or mobile internet are the options left for those 2 million households. And that's really good news for Satellite Solutions.
I mean, is there a degree of government subsidy in this as well? Or is it just a policy directive at the moment?
Oh, no, there is. I mean, there's an initiative in Britain whereby the kit, which is actually quite expensive, it's not the same as signing up to TalkTalk or BT for your fiber broadband, where you pay, you know, at most £50 and sometimes nothing to become a customer. The kit here is hundreds of pounds. So in Britain, there is a subsidy scheme to actually subsidise the cost of that kit. by the governments, which is helping, and Italy and France. And these aren't the only countries in Europe that are actually doing it.
Because I guess it's linked into the whole issue of regional development as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right there. So, for example, Satellite Solutions has just launched a government-backed 40 megabyte satellite scheme in Cornwall. So that's one of the most remote parts of the country with not the greatest broadband access. They've just bought a company called Quickline last month, paid £5 million for it, brought in 4,500 new customers. This is actually fixed line wireless broadband. But the interesting thing here is that Quickline has already been awarded a £2 million grant by a quango called Broadband Delivery UK as part of the Department of Culture, Media and Sports. And that award is to support the rollout of superfast fixed wireless broadband in Lincolnshire. Well, anyway, Quickline is also on the shortlist for Yorkshire, and the grant there is upwards of £20 million.
Okay, that's
with
serious.
With deployment expected in the second half.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're talking big bucks here. If you actually get awarded these grants, and Quickline hasn't been awarded that grant. It's just on the shortlist at the moment, but expect news on it quite soon. So it could be a game changer for Satellite Solutions if that happens.
Hmm.
But these aren't the only parts of the country where this is happening. So it's actually gathering momentum as well.
Okay, well, listen, that's definitely one to watch. In fact, the subsector itself, from the sound of it, too. Okay, Simon. Well, listen, it's been it's great speaking to you again, and thanks very much on the updates. No doubt we'll be talking to you in a future podcast as well. So we'll let you get back to what you were doing. See you later.
Absolutely. Take care. Cheers. Bye.
Okay, well, that just about wraps it up for this week as well. So it's thanks very much to Tom and Megan, and of course our old friend Simon as well. Some interesting insights there. It's been quite a sort of interesting week on the geopolitical front as well. I mean, we're having more ructions from North Korea, and the unfortunate incidents down in Texas as well, where Hurricane Harvey has wreaked devastation. I think that Ian Smith may be looking at some of the implications, and Alex Newman as well, looking at implications for the oil price, and also on insurance premiums as well. But that will be for a later date in the magazine. In addition to the areas that we've covered so far, Megan, who's just been speaking to us, has been taking a look at AI's influence on UK pharma research. Interesting piece there. There's Tom's look at the outsourcing market. Another article well worth a look is Harriet Klarfeldt's take on the corporate governance reform that's being floated by the government at the moment, or it's been watered down depending on which way you look at it. In News Spotlight this week, I've been having a look at the gold-silver ratio. We had that in Chart of the Week last week, the argument being that we think it's hit an inflection point that could see silver outperform its precious metal rival over the coming months, and perhaps as long as 2 years. It's an interesting viewpoint as well. And we've got a comment there from ETF Securities, Nitesh Shah as well, just looking at that issue too. So that might be interesting from a trading perspective. But that's about it for this week. So thanks very much again to all our guests. And we'll look forward to speaking to you at some point in the future. Goodbye.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.